Hello, travelers and diners of the world. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. I hope it's something you do frequently if you want to keep up with all the latest buzz on food, wine, travel, and lifestyle. We have a lineup, usually a fabulous guest, and today is no exception. On the line is Andrea Nguyen. Nguyen? Andrea, help me out.
Nguyen, like
Nguyen.
Nguyen.
Nguyen. Nguyen.
And as usual, I mean, she's out of practice. She forgot to introduce co-host Peter.
Oh, sorry.
Who's sitting here just doubly running the recorder and generally being part of the furniture, but he is here.
Hello, Rabbit. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Anyway, okay. let's get back to our great guest.
Yeah, now, Andrea, you've written this book that I think everybody should get a hold of called Into the Vietnamese Kitchen. And you got praise from just about every quarter in the culinary world. And I can understand why. It's a delicious book. And well, let's back up and explain to us, you had a very dramatic exit from Vietnam. Could you tell us briefly about that?
Sure, Anne. Thank you. Thank you, Anna Peter, for having me on this morning. You know, my family was able to leave Saigon, our family where we lived. Our family was a family of seven, and we were able to leave 1 week before the fall of Saigon in April of 1975.
Which was a miracle, wasn't it?
Yes. And we had been planning a sea voyage escape, and at that point, the government prohibited all seafaring vessels that were not official from leaving the Saigon harbor. And my father had been planning that escape for many, many months. And so he scrambled and went all over town trying to find some way of leaving. And finally, a man who had worked with my aunt 8 years earlier in Saigon had suddenly reappeared. He was an American man who had worked with the State Department. He had come back to Saigon to try to pull out as many people as he could, and he was offering to take my aunt, and she offered to take a few of my sisters, and my father said, no, I would like to take the entire family. And at the last moment, this particular gentleman he said, okay, well, we'll take the whole family. And that was the next day we left, and we just packed two small suitcases and really more like handbags, to tell you the truth. And my mother, in her handbag, her purse, carried a small notebook filled with her recipes.
Now, tell us why. I mean, this is a significant thing that she brought with her. But one of the themes of your book is preserving the heritage of your culture through the food.
Yes. Well, you know, people of my parents' generation, they're both in their 70s, had to be forced to migrate in throughout Vietnamese history for many times. And my mother knew very well that food is very important when you have to leave home and you're displaced. And so she wanted to come to the United States and make Vietnamese food for all the other Vietnamese people who were coming here. And she thought, you know, it would be great to have something to chew on when they came here. And she knew that it would be such an unusual alien environment to make Vietnamese food. So she tucked all of her precious belongings along with this little skinny orange notebook into her purse. And when we came here, indeed, you know, there was just, like, nothing available in regular supermarkets. There was no fish sauce in a supermarket. and we had, you know, bad soy sauce and bad rice for months until we could get a car and drive up to the closest Chinatown, which was located in Los Angeles. But, you know, we didn't live near many other Vietnamese people when we came to the United States. And so the way that we were able to really get a sense of who we are was through eating fabulous food that my mother would make from scratch. And it was because, you know, in Vietnam, you go outside, you pick things up from vendors and whatnot, specialty food items. But we didn't have that convenience here. And she had always been an excellent cook. And she just really kind of rose to the challenge when she came here.
And she was a stickler for etiquette and formality.
Exactly.
Tradition, I guess, is the word.
It's tradition, it's classical methods, and she did so many wonderful things. But the most important thing was that both of my parents set up their work lives so that they had flexible schedules, so we always sat down to a family meal every single day.
Yeah, that's important.
Yes. We could not afford to go out and eat all seven of us. So.
Oh, that's a lot. What a family, huh?
Yeah.
Now, you have a section here on the roots of Vietnamese cooking, and I think people, because Vietnamese cooking is so popular now, have some rough idea, but can you just rip through some of the sources of it?
Sure, sure. You know, I think a lot of people associate Vietnamese cooking with French cooking, and people oftentimes tell me it's very heavily influenced by France. And you know, to a certain degree, it is influenced by France. France was officially Vietnam's colonial ruler for 75 years. But, you know, Vietnamese history spans so long, and the Chinese were in Vietnam for about, on and off, 1,000 years. And the Vietnamese geography, being a very long and skinny country and with a super long coastline, roughly the coastline of the eastern seaboard, we're talking about 2,100 miles, so there was a lot of contact with outsiders. So as a result, when you travel from north to south Vietnam, you in the north you see a lot of Chinese influence. In the central region around Hue, you see a lot of the Cham influence. Down around Saigon, so then the southern region, you see the Khmer influence, Thai, Indian, and all of, during all of that, you know, we had ingredients like chilies and tomatoes that were brought by the Portuguese.
Yeah, the Portuguese were everywhere.
Yes, they were all over the place, Anne. So, you know, it's this amalgam of all different kinds of Eastern and Southeastern, South Asian, as well as Western culinary influences, and I think that that's what makes it highly unusual.
And what do you think is the singular distinguishing characteristic as opposed to all the other Southeast Asian cuisines?
I think that there is a lot of raw herbs. And
I think so, too.
Yeah.
That's great. I love that section where you had the photographs of the herbs.
Yes, yes. And it's very healthy. You know, a lot of people in Asia eat their vegetables cooked. And if they do eat some raw herbs, it's just sort of a garnish kind of thing. But we eat it practically like it's another vegetable. In fact, in Vietnamese, herbs are translated as fragrant vegetable.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, tell us about caramel sauce.
I beg your pardon?
It's caramel sauce.
Oh, caramel sauce. Yes, yes, yes. Thank you for asking, because that's one of my favorite ingredients. And I think it could be a special ingredient.
Oh, it's the most unusual one, I think.
Yes, it is. You know, and I don't, and it's the best way to translate it is caramel sauce, because it is nearly burnt sugar, and you stop it right at the end before it turns, you know, super bitter black. And in Vietnam, you can make it from a wide range of different kinds of sugars, even coconut juice that you cook down. But here in the United States, white sugar is fine, and you essentially just simmer it until it renders itself into almost like the color of a big red wine, like a Barolo or something, or a big cab. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, you stop the cooking process because it is very hot and smoking, and then you add water to it. And what happens is the result is like this bitter, sweet, inky, almost viscous liquid that then you would use as a foundation for simmering homey food. And the neat thing about it is I compare it to like our little cheat of the Maillard effect, which is where you're searing meat like roast over hot heat, and then it gets all the sugars get caramelized. Well, what we do is we take caramel sauce and we'll combine it with a little soy sauce and maybe a little extra sugar, and we simmer chicken or pork or fish, and it gets this wonderful savory sweet quality, and that's like the soul of Vietnamese home cooking. You eat that with rice and it's just lovely.
Right. Now, I read where you carefully adapted all these recipes to the American kitchen. Before we started this interview, I said, reading this, your writing style is so lucid, I'm just impressed as anything with this.
Thank you. And
I said to you, I think I could actually make some of these. Now, you, in the introduction, or someplace I read, this is all adapted to the American kitchen. Tell us about that.
You know, what it is it's the American kitchen, it's the modern kitchen. And, you know, we have conveniences here, a lot of that people don't have in Vietnam, for example. But you can make Vietnamese food just as well. For example, there is an entire chapter devoted to Vietnamese charcuterie. And if you're unfamiliar with it, but if you've had a Vietnamese sandwich, a banh mi sandwich is very popular right. for Vietnamese food enthusiasts, you've probably had some of this charcuterie. And it's not like mystery meat. It's actually just a lot of different kinds of meat paste. And in Vietnam, in the olden days, it was traditionally made by hand in a mortar and pestle. And, you know, I have instructions on how to do it by hand, but many people in the United States now prepare it with a food processor.
Right.
And it's okay. The texture is wonderful. So, you know, things like that, I think that people need to feel like it's not a laborious cuisine. Yes, there's chopping involved, but at the same time, you know, there are many kind of modern appliances such as food processors, and we take for granted the refrigerator that allows you to kind of pace the food preparation out. And you know, I oftentimes tell Vietnamese people when I give talks in the community that, gosh, you know, we came to the United States for freedom and many other reasons, but including refrigeration and potable water.
<That's>
because it allows us to prepare food, you know, that was difficult in the past when we lived in Vietnam with a refrigerator. You can, like, do things in advance. You can make pho noodle soup and freeze it. You can make great Vietnamese salads and, like, keep them in the refrigerator for several days in advance and bring everything together at the end. And it doesn't have to be a chore. And you know, that goes for people who are non-Vietnamese and Vietnamese as well. So that, you know, I teach people how to prepare these foods. And the book offers instruction as well. And I don't see why Vietnamese food can't become part of the American repertoire.
No, it should. I mean, this is everybody who wants to just drop in and eat something goes to a Vietnamese restaurant in Pittsburgh, I know. Now, you are a food writer, a culinary instructor, and you have a website that I think listeners should check out, which is all about the food and culture of Vietnam. It's www.vietworldkitchen.com.
Yeah.
And anybody can, of course, get your book from there and also from our website, which is onthemenuradio.com, www.onthemenuradio.com. And I wanted to wrap with you went back to Vietnam with your husband, did you?
Yes.
When was that?
That we've been back twice, and our last trip was last January.
And you found that street food was going, huh?
Yes. And, you know, it's every single time I go back, it's different. The country's different. And I encourage people who have never been to Vietnam to go visit. It is a country that's absolutely lovely. And
it's gorgeous,
open.
I hear.
Yes. But it's changing constantly. I mean, every moment, people who go back for business on a regular basis tell me that things are changing. And restaurants are popping up like mushrooms, they tell me.
Oh, yes.
So the food scene is fabulous, and I encourage people to go. And people are extremely friendly there.
And that's what I hear, too.
So you don't have any bad memories of the fact that you had to leave under such difficult circumstances?
You know, the first time that I returned, which was in 2003, it was shocking, to tell you the truth. You know, just to land at Tan Son Nhat Airport in Saigon, which is the airport where we departed from, that was very emotional. And to also to visit our family's former home, which, you know, I was a kid, I thought, oh my goodness, it's so big. And then when I saw it and it had been, you know, subdivided and turned into like government offices and a bunch of families living there, and I looked at it and I thought, it's so small.
Aww.
Vietnam is a wonderful, wonderful country, and I have my heart there, but I also spent most of my life in the United States, and so it's very emotional to have gone back, but I also feel that I have a place here in the United States, and I'm very grateful for having been able to come here.
Well, we're grateful for you for writing this book. It's Into the Vietnamese Kitchen, and the deck subtitle on that, listeners, is Treasured Foodways, Modern Flavors. And I think it meets all those criteria, holds up those standards very well. And your delight, Andrea. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you, Peter and Ann.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now we'll take a break. Ladies and gentlemen, stay with us and come back to us on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Don't forget that you can keep track of all the activities at On the Menu Radio by going to our website, www.onthemenuradio.com, and you can email us anytime at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Talk about a change of speed. We're going to change sex. We're going to change sides of the planet, but we're still going to be on the same subject of superstar chefs with fascinating stories.
They call Robert Irvine the 007 of chefs. No less a person than Bobby Flay has called him the Indiana Jones of chefs. And he's recently come out with a book called Mission Cook. And a number of people have suggested that the things that he does in the culinary field are a lot like Mission Impossible. Robert, welcome to the show. Good morning, and thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Peter. Thanks for having me.
As we were saying off the air, the British are coming, the British are coming.
Yeah, you know, you hear all these stories about, oh, the British can't cook. Well, they can cook, and I believe we're going to reclaim our former glory at some point. Probably not in mine in your lifetime, but it'll be interesting to see.
So behind Gordon Ramsay and Robert Irvine, we're conquering the world again, huh?
Yes, we're getting there. Although Gordon's a little bit different. He's a little bit more high-strung than me, I believe, and great chef, though. Absolutely an amazing chef.
Well, you've had quite a career, so tell our listeners how it all started.
I joined the Royal Navy at the age of 15. I was working at a place called Royal Naval Air Station in Cundrose in Cornwall when the electric watt came out, and just so happened I was the guy that was going to cook with this electric watt, and the Prince of Wales, whom I had no idea who he was, came into the room. He asked me what I was cooking, and I was reading a pamphlet, a little booklet about how to cook with this machine, the wok. And he said, well, you're a chef, you can cook anything, correct? And I'm like, yes, sir, absolutely. What would you like? And he said, I'd like this. And I said, okay, this is what I can do for you. And I cooked that dish. He came back afterwards and absolutely adored it, said it was wonderful, thank you very much. Chef. Well, you know, I'm 15 and a half years old. And he said, he called me a chef. I'd been in basic training for 6 weeks. I thought, oh, that was great. So for the next 3 months, every day he came back at the same time to have lunch and said, oh, can I have what I had yesterday?
Now, what did you cook for him, Robert?
Well, it wasn't even, there was no name to it. It was just a bunch of stuff in a pan at that point. You know, spring bamboo shoots and onions and peppers and with garlic, soy sauce and things like that. So it really had no name. But as we went through the 3 months, I tried to keep doing what I did the first day. Well, you know as well as I do, Peter, when you cook at home or you cook in a restaurant, you don't repeat things twice. You don't. Because you can't remember what you put in it.
So it wasn't quite the same. Now
it was never the same.
but much later, you captured everything in recipes, and they're the recipes that are in the book.
Right, exactly. And it was funny because a couple of weeks after, I was summoned to my boss's office, and I thought I was in trouble for being out late the night before. And we ended up to meet the Prince of Wales in London, Buckingham Palace. I was there for 4.5 hours talking about my family, my finances. Well, you can imagine, I was making £300 a month at that time, and I would go out with the guys, and there would be nothing left, so it was more like in the red 300. And he asked me all these questions about my family, my finances and things. 2 days later, I was on the way back to Royal Naval Air Station called Rose, and I was sent to the Royal Britannia.
There you go.
In Italy.
So then you served for no less a person than the Queen herself?
Yes, I was with the Queen and the Prince and Princess of Wales for 10 years.
Now, what did they like to eat for breakfast?
Kippers. The Queen would eat kippers, and Charles and Diana. Diana was a very finicky eater, but Charles would always eat, eggs and bacon and scrambled eggs, that is.
So the full English breakfast was indeed consumed by at least one member of the royal family.
Absolutely. Actually, a lot more than that. But, English breakfasts are a staple in English life. Even today, I still do the same thing.
There you go. You mean you still cook it, or you still eat it, or both?
I do both, yeah.
Well, Now, this book is two things mixed together, I think. If I'm reading it correctly, it's a life story, a story of some of your more exciting experiences with the sort of Mission Impossible edge, but it's also a compilation of cookbooks. Which would you like to talk about first?
Well, I think you're correct, and it's more of an autobiographical account of some of the funny stuff I've done. Each of them funny stories has recipes attached to it. So I think it's both, and let's talk about life.
There you go. Tell us, go through the Yemen story. I mean, that's really quite fascinating. It's almost the first recipe in the book.
Yeah, well, Yemen, if I look back now, which was in 1986, and here we are in 2007, almost 8, 20 years ago, that would have been my first Dinner Impossible show, had I known 20 years ago. We were actually on our way to New Zealand, Australia, with the Majesty of the Queen on board the Royal Yacht Britannia. We were diverted to Yemen. There was an uprising, and for those people who don't know, the Royal Yacht Britannia is actually classified as a hospital ship, or she was at the time. She's now decommissioned. But that meant wherever she was needed, she would have to go to. So she was diverted. The captain, who was a full-ranking admiral, the only one in the British Royal Navy, by the way, asked me, well, what do we have to feed 3,000 people? I just looked at him. We're on the Royal Yacht Britannia. We normally feed 250, 300 people maximum at any one time. He said, okay, you've got 20 minutes. Come back and tell me. Well, we did have, you know, rice, pork, sugar, and all the pretty basic staples, and garbage containers. Yeah, and clean ones, I might add.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. Perhaps we better tease the audience and say, listen, if you want to know the rest of the story, you'll just have to buy the book. It's called Mission Cook. You can buy it through the On the Menu website under OTM Bookshelf. So in order not to dwell on that, let's go on. Pick a couple of other highlights for us, Robert.
Jamaica was one.
Jamaica? Okay, what happened in Jamaica?
I arrived in Jamaica as this military, staunch military guy, and it was raining. Nobody came to work when it rained in Jamaica. Well, I had a hotel of 720 rooms. People still had to be fed. There was 2,000 guests.
So at this point, you had left the Navy and you were a chef. You were the chef there?
Yes, I was a chef there, yeah. Sorry. You know, my boss had just came down from Baltimore when I was working for Renaissance Hotels. He walked into the kitchen. This guy is 6'7", sort of 400 pounds. I said, well, where are all the cooks? And I said, well, this is what happens in Jamaica when it rains. You know, they don't have transport. So luckily, over a year period, we managed to get them transport to get them to work. But the real funny story about this is 3 weeks into being at the Jamaica Grand Hotel, I'm sitting in an office, and all of a sudden, I start to cry. And I'm thinking, what on earth is, what's going on? There was a young man outside the door with a buffalo chopper, like a blender. And he was blending 3-4 cases of little peppers, Scotch bonnet peppers. Well, it got into the ductwork, and anybody in the kitchen would literally almost die of this stuff.
Oh, sure. Yeah, this is not quite the hottest pepper. I understand there is one that's slightly hotter, but it's right up there.
But he was wrapped in plastic wrap from head to foot. So I not only was I almost gagging and choking to death, I was laughing at the same time. But I didn't know what he was doing. It took me a couple of weeks to figure out what he was doing. So every Tuesday from that day on, once I understood it, I went outside for about an hour and a half till he'd finished doing what he was doing. But that story is called The Plastic Ninja.
We had a similar experience years ago when we had cats, and we grated some fresh horseradish in the kitchen, and the cats just wailed because they were very sensitive to the very powerful emission raw horseradish. If Anne was here, she could tell the rest of the story. I can't remember why we were making it. Now, in addition to having written this book, this is your first book?
This is my first book, yes.
But you also do a program called Dinner Impossible.
Yes, this is my show on the Food Network, which is now the highest rated show on television.
The highest on the Food Network or just on television general?
On television general.
My goodness, I didn't know that. We don't watch the Food Channel a lot, I must say. We got rather tired of the fact that it was all the same old people. We're going to have to come back. Are you still on the air?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Okay, then we'll have to come back and start
the funny part
the
is
show.
It's not a cooking show. It's a cooking show. It's almost like a sports show with food, as it was described. You know, predominantly the Food Network has a demographic of an 18-year-old female to a 43-year-old/female And Dinner Impossible has literally taken it from a 4-year-old to an 84-year-old, predominantly 60% male, which is a very interesting turn.
You bet it. I bet the Food Network people are excited about it. About
yeah,
that.
They're very excited. But for me, it's teaching people it's okay to cook, and it's okay to burn things, and it's okay to make mistakes, because everybody does. I think what makes it successful is because, you know, they put me in positions with no knowledge, no food, no equipment, a timeline, and normally to cook for a lot of people. If you think about that, we do that every day when we come home and your children or whatever have to go to a sports event after school. You feed them. But what do you feed them? Well, whatever's in a kitchen.
There you go. Now, you've been in the restaurant business. Do you think you'll go back into the restaurant business again, or are you having too much fun just...
Well, I'm having so much fun. I still have a company that does consulting. We're opening two restaurants of my own in St. Petersburg, Florida, in Florida in January, mid to end of January. So I'm always going to be in that business. Well, I love it.
Do you know Crazy Tony Baudin?
I do know Tony, yes.
In some respects, you have some things in common, I think.
Well, Tony's kind of a what I would call a waif and a stray. He does so many things, it's very hard to put him where he is, what he does. You know, I love his program on television. I think sometimes he's a little outspoken, but he did say some things about me till he apologized.
There you go. He does that a lot, I understand.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't know me. You know, before you're going to ever talk to anybody, you have to understand who they are and what they've done. And he wrote some things about me on a blog from a television show I did at the Food Network. And once we contacted him and whatnot, he rescinded the silly comments. But I do really like him. I think he has some very good points about food and people and... just he's a little bit aggressive on the blogging.
He does put his foot firmly in his mouth and other people's mouths at the same time, wouldn't you think?
Yes, yeah.
Talk to me about the wonderful and surprising emergence of new British cuisine.
You know, it was funny because I was just in L.A. a couple of days ago launching the DVD for Ratatouille. I have a special segment of 8 minutes on the Walmart and some special edition tapes where I'm out in Ratatouille in L.A. doing some things with some kids. And one of the questions I got from the 53 TV stations that were there on that red carpet was, well, the English can't cook. I mean, how come, you know, you're doing stuff with the French guys and the English can't cook? And my reply to them was, well, the top 10 restaurants in the world are in London.
Now, we would have a little bit of a fight about that from people in New York, don't you think?
Well, that's rated by all these bodies, so I agree with the bodies. The thing with English cuisine, you know, it was always... I grew up on it, and I'm not doing bad, and so did you. But they said, well, you know, it's all stodgy, there's no... You're right, but times have changed since then.
Yes, yeah.
You know, people have become a lot more healthy, not so much in England, but the chefs are creating healthier food that look very appetizing, look pretty. They look, you know, foo-foo, for the want of a better word. And the restaurants there are great. I was just back at Christmas.
Now, who would be at the top of the list for you? Heston Blumenthal, maybe?
I would say, I mean, there's a number of people that are great. I couldn't put one person above another. But I think because chefs are all so different and so creative, you know, I love some of the French guys in this country because they are, and I think Michel Richard wrote on the back of the book, you know, I'm starting to like English food because of Robert Irvine, which is a big turn up because he's a classical French guy and... But I was trained by two French guys, Michel and Albert Roux. So
there you go. Oh, so you know them very well. One of the very best meals we ever had was at the Waterside Inn. Young Alain was in charge of the kitchen, and he cooked a wonderful meal for us.
That's incredible. I mean, the places are incredible. So I think the emergence of people sharing things, you know, not only food but lifestyles and stories, because that's what creates food. You go to a place, you like it, you take an ingredient, and you figure out what you're going to do with it.
Now, one of the things my wife always likes to ask chefs is, do they have a favorite ingredient? So, do you have a favorite ingredient?
I don't have a favorite protein, although I do love to work with lamb. I do love rice wine vinegar. I do love stone ground mustard, and I have a demi-glass powder, which I live for.
There you go. I asked Thomas Keller from the French Laundry in Pussy recently, because he was in Pittsburgh, and he thought about it for a minute, and then he said salt. Whatever turns you on.
He does, because he has in his kitchen probably 20 different types of salt.
I have almost that many in mine, curiously enough.
Really?
Well, lots of people send us things. We try to stay up to date on all the wonderful ingredients that are out there. One we have that we really adore is some peppercorns from Australia, specifically from Tasmania, and we really love those because they're like pepper, but they're not.
Yes, yeah.
If you've never tried that particular spice, I would commend it to you. And, of course, most chefs we ask say foie gras.
I love it.
You can take that or leave it, huh?
But I can take it or leave it. It's not a big big thing for me.
Now,
I like things that can add depth and flavor.
There we go.
Mustard, in any way, shape, or form, does that. Rice wine vinegar gives you the acidity, as opposed to using orange, lemon, or whatever. And demi, well, you know, we all use demi as a mother sauce.
Oh, of course, yes. In fact, we have a friend in Pittsburgh who isn't even a chef. He's a president of a hospital foundation, and he makes his own veal stock.
Wow, that's wonderful.
So, Robert, last thoughts for our listeners. We'll go back over the details. The book is called Mission Cook. The author is Robert Irvine, who's a Brit who knows how to cook. Which some people would at one time have thought was totally impossible. He's the Mission Impossible. He's Dinner Impossible on the Food Channel. He's done lots and lots of other exciting things. Some last thoughts for our listeners before we sign off.
Well, whatever you do with food, try and plan it a little bit so you don't get all stressed about it, especially with the holidays coming up. You know, a little forethought can save you a lot of agony afterwards. If you make your menu, buy your food and prep a little, so on the day the event is, you don't have to be stuck in the kitchen. It's got to be fun. Involve your family, and then you'll just have a great time.
There we go. Because after all, when it comes right down to it, the family table is where it's at.
Absolutely.
So the extended family in England got together to eat, and still does. The ultimate extended families are probably those in Italy and France. Extended family is less so in the United States, but there are recipes in Mission Cook that will help to reintroduce that transition into your household. And Robert, I think that's a wonderful recommendation, and I'm just delighted you were able to join our show this morning and we had the opportunity to talk to each other. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you, Peter. It was great to be here, and if anybody wants to get hold of great recipes, Peter, they can log on to chefrobertirvine.com. There's a great news.
Well, that's a great tip to end up with, too. So thank you so much, Robert, and I'm going to stop the recording right now.
Do you think if Andrea and Robert got together, they'd have a lot to talk about? I think so. Anyway, it was fun to talk to both of them, but now it's time to take a break. So stay with us, and we'll catch up with you in just a few seconds.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu. Remember that you can track everything that we're up to at www.onthemenuradio.com. And if you'd like us to hear from you, and we'd be delighted to hear from you, you can send us email at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. And we have another interesting guest for you from deep in the heart of Texas, a grown-up family business, and the man now in charge. I think the third generation, Doug Renfro, who's the president of Renfro Foods in Fort Worth, Texas, the proverbial cow town. Doug, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you.
And so tell us a story about how this business grew. It must have been quite an exciting time in the very beginning.
It was. I believe my grandmother thought my grandfather was insane. He made it through the Depression with a good job, and as soon as the Depression was ending up and things were returning to normality, he started his own food distribution company initially in 1940.
So he did sort of like an opposite Willie Loman thing, huh?
In reverse, yes.
And decided that he couldn't count on other people to support him. He would support himself.
I keep a nice photograph of him in the 30s in a coat and tie beside his sales panel van on a dirt road in Texas outside my office. And I have to think it must have been incredibly hot and humid.
So you're reminded how fortunate you are that you sit in an air-conditioned office while you run the enterprise And do you think when he looks down from upstairs, he's smiling?
I certainly hope so.
No, I feel sure that he must be. That was what intrigued us so much about the Renfrew Foods product line, that it goes back to the very beginning. But there have been some steps along the way, too. So once the business got going, then what happened?
He initially was distributing and supplying some grocery stores and restaurants. And then we've always had our eyes open as opportunities arise. He found an opportunity to take over syrup manufacturing from another company that was stumbling, and we always increase the quality and the variety of whatever products we look upon. So at one point he was supplying most of the restaurants in North Texas with their syrup, and then after another point in time he ran into an opportunity to sell and develop relishes. And by the time I came along as a child, relishes, the southern specialty called chow chow, as well as tomato relish and corn relish, were really our forte and what we spent most of our efforts on. And still in the U.S. today, we're still the number one chow chow maker. Most of my friends in school thought that was dog food, but it's not.
No, it's an interesting problem. We'll have to talk about that a little bit later on, because us up north, we're not all that familiar with chow chow.
So it's a fairly finite area that it's sold in.
There we go. And so your father took over the business?
My father and my uncle, actually. My grandfather had three children, and two went into the business. My father is more manufacturing operations oriented. My uncle is more sales administrative oriented. And out of seven grandkids, three of us are in the business, and I'm on the R&D sales marketing side, a cousin in the operations side, and a cousin who sort of does accounts payable, receivable, freight, insurance, that sort of thing, and housekeeping.
So it really is still very much all in the family, huh?
Very much so. There are lots of, some days we say too much.
And is the next generation going to stay in the same business, do you think?
We're not sure. We've put up a filter, so to speak, saying that the fourth generation must graduate from college and work at another company for at least 2 years if they want to come back into the business. So far, no one has done that, but the door is still open. And a lot of them are too young to be able to tell yet.
Right. Now, when did you start in the business, and what were you doing?
Well, I first worked here every summer since sixth grade, doing really, really nasty, hot, wet jobs such as chopping cabbage and toting trash carts around and things, which is great training. Doesn't pay well. Then all through college, I was the spicer, coming in the afternoon, late afternoon and into the early evening, mixing all the spices for the next day. So when I graduated, that was about as much fun as I could have at the time, and we didn't need any more executives, so I went off to a big multi-billion-dollar corporation to wear a coat and tie every day and stay clean.
Was that escape, or did it just seemed like the right thing to do at the time?
Both. It was escape, and it was great education. I went ahead and got a master's degree and an advanced certification, and had some great experience, met some great people, learned a lot of things. But after about 7 years, I'd had enough of corporate life and wanted to contribute more directly to society and be more in the line of fire, so to speak.
Okay, so you went back. Nobody said you must come back. You decided to go back on your own?
I went back. They were probably going to sell out if they didn't have a fresh infusion. And myself and my two cousins, being younger, they rolled the dice and let us start doing some creative things and took it to the next level. We've grown about fivefold in the last 15 years. And my dad and my uncle are very happy about it and have enjoyed the ride and are still coming into the office most days, working pretty much a full week, but having the satisfaction of not having to do all the heavy lifting.
Well, that's just terrific. Now, you bought a number of other companies along the way, I think.
We have. It was early on. Those were transactions. My grandfather executed a couple with the syrup and the relish side, and then my father and my uncle did this with a taco sauce manufacturing company in the early mid-70s, which was our first entry into that realm. At that point in time, nobody used the word salsa, and picante was a very ethnic-specific term as opposed to what later became the number one condiment, surpassing ketchup.
So salsa's where it's at these days, huh?
Yes, and more specifically, we developed the variety salsas for the grocery market to be our entree as to why a buyer would want yet another brand of salsa on his store shelves.
So explain this term variety, because I mean I think of salsa as being, at least until I came across Mrs. Renfrew's, salsa was just a red substance, and it came in mild, medium, and hot, and sometimes crazy hot, but it always looked the same. It always had like a tomato base, and it always had peppers in it. You've taken it in some totally different directions.
Right. When I came back here from the corporate world, we had exactly that, mild, medium, and hot. And when we approached buyers about a new line of salsa, they really had no interest at all. So I got to be in charge of the R&D department by default, which was actually quite fun, and created a black bean and a habanero salsa, which existed at the gourmet level, maybe $9.99 at a nice gourmet outlet. But what we were trying to be is on your everyday shopping list at, say, $2.79 with a variety of flavor. And it quickly became a very successful strategy. So we followed that up over the years with peach, chipotle corn, raspberry chipotle, roasted garlic, mango habanero. And then these have been very successful in giving people a reason to try Mrs. Renfro's as opposed to any other brand on the shelf.
So you think that the Mrs. Renfro name implies something, doesn't it?
It's got a quite rabid following, and now that we're selling a few million jars a year, my grandmother's impression is on every closure. I think it brings a little taste of home and authenticity to the product, and it's actually made in Texas. It's not a salsa that's made in New Jersey or New York or California. It has a lot of history and authenticity behind it.
Now, you're also doing pickles and nacho peppers and that kind of thing as well?
We do. We tend to expand our line and see if a product is right for us in terms of machinery and efficiency, and if we can provide a new quality service. We do a nacho cheese sauce, which is a chili con queso. We still make corn relish and chow chow. We have a barbecue sauce, and then we manufacture for a lot of other people who don't have their own assembly lines so that we can keep the efficiencies going after the Renfro business has been fulfilled for the day.
Now, we ran across a gentleman called, was it Stubbs? I think he had a barbecue shop in Austin, Texas.
Right.
And then somebody took it over and started a line of rubs and spices and sauces. Are you familiar with those?
I was actually answering an email from their CEO when you called me.
Oh, no kidding. So you know them quite well.
Good industry friends of ours, yeah.
Well, they've done it. They do an extremely good job. We have a couple of cases of their products still left. And it's really an amazing product. I mean, yours is amazing too, but his is all the more amazing because he was really an entrepreneur with a single restaurant, and then somebody, I guess, took over his ideas and made a product line out of them.
Yeah, they actually helped Mr. Stubblefield had lost control of his own name through a bad marketing.
Oh, is that what happened? I didn't know the details of that. We got a book about his life, but because it didn't include the nasty parts like that.
Yeah, these three young men got together and felt sorry for him, and then started to organize the funding to buy his name back and created this company. And he actually he passed away fairly early on, but he did get to go on David Letterman, and he was at some of the trade shows I attended and got to enjoy some fame and notoriety and money to go along with the resurgence in his own brand.
Well, he seemed like a fine man with an interesting message, and just a sort of a great American story that somebody helped him out, and I didn't realize they had. Your products are available throughout the United States, Doug?
Right. We're available in all 50 states, all Canadian provinces, and the AC Nielsen tracks about 600 brands of salsa. We're roughly number 14, so we're sort of the biggest little guys.
There you go, and that makes you feel good. You don't want to be the biggest big guy.
No, we don't. That's too scary.
Now, you told me something really interesting, that you're now taking Mrs. Renfro overseas.
We are. We found a gentleman in London who had done a good job for some industry friends of ours, and he has been peddling the product. I've gone to London two or three times with them and helped present the salsa, and we found a distributor who brought over four pallets, which is a few thousand jars, and they've sold through that and are reordering, and we're giving them some promotional displays and trying to introduce a little Fort Worth, Texas into the United Kingdom.
Yeah, well, we're going over there at close to the end of the year, so where would we be able to find it?
I have that somewhere here. I'll have to search my emails for a moment.
Well, you can send me an email later to onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com and let us know where we should look for it, and we'll introduce some of our relatives to something good tasting coming out of America. I'm not sure that they would believe there would be such a thing, but we'll try to convince them. they're a very insular lot, the English. I'm glad that you're having some success. I'm not sure that my relatives quite have the palate for that, but we'll try them and see.
I'll send that to you as soon as I hang up here.
That's great. And we were talking off the air, and I feel sure that an Australian connection would be good for you as well. So you ought to explore that as well.
Would love to.
Now, do people need a store locator to be able to find a product, or is it available in just about every supermarket chain across the country?
It's in about 98% of the major chains in the country. We've been very diligent. We've been fortunate. We've also spent a lot of money and time over the last 15 years, especially just pushing hard, marketing the brand, begging, pleading, yelling. And I've been pretty successful in getting into just about every chain. It'll vary from store to store as to do they have two items versus six, but we've got it pretty well rounded out.
Now, what do you think is next? What's the next market venture? What's the next product style, do you think, for Mrs. Renfro?
I'm actually working on three new flavors. Everyone wants new. They want to know what's the latest. And to some extent, the things you already make are what cover your profits. But to build a business for the future, you need to always have that eye on what's next, what's around the corner. The heat and sweet, the fruit pepper combination has still been big. There's some specific peppers that continue. If you recall, 10 years ago, nobody knew what a chipotle was, and now it's just very commonplace. So we don't want to be so unique that nobody recognizes what they're buying, but we also want to be creative because we are known to be on the edge. And by that, I mean on the edge of taste profiles for the product salsa.
There we go. So we can expect more from Mrs. Renfro?
Yes, you can. Hopefully unveiling next summer.
Oh, that'll be great. Do you go to the Fancy Food Show in New York?
Yes, we exhibit in San Francisco and New York every year.
Okay, well, we don't go to San Francisco, but we'll make a point of looking you up in New York in July, because it's the biggest one. In fact, it's so big it's almost out of control, isn't it?
It is enormous, and they let me speak to an educational group about how to get into that business, and I can tell you there are usually 50 to 100 people there trying to make the show even larger the following year.
Right. I think that, in fact, that's why we ran across Jane, and she tried to introduce us to you then, and it just didn't fit into our schedule. So I'm so glad that we were able to get connected, and we'll hook up again in July, and we'll see what you have in mind then.
Well, thanks. I appreciate your time.
Well, this has been a wonderful, from deep in the heart of Texas, listeners, Mrs. Renfro's line of wonderful salsas and other products. You should get some. A last thought for our listeners, Doug?
Stay tuned for more, and we have everything you need from mild to spicy wild.
There you go. That's a nice way to finish. Spicy wild it is. Thank you, Doug. Have a great day.
Thanks very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
It's time for us to take another break, but be sure to stay with us because we have another fascinating interview coming up right after the music.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
If you're regular listeners to On the Menu, you probably know that On the Menu loves gadgets. And in particular, but in this case, the gadgets that we're going to talk about are gadgets that are right in Peter's department because they're designed for the outdoor and amateur cook. So let's hear it for a company called Polder Inc.
Okay, when I was studying geography, polder meant a piece of reclaimed land, specifically one that was in a country called the Netherlands, a lot of people call Holland. And we're talking today to Kerry Cooper, who's the vice president of marketing for Polder Inc., which isn't in the reclaiming land business, but there is a connection. Kerry, go ahead and explain that.
Okay. Peter, thanks. First of all, thanks for having me on. Polder is a consumer housewares brand that was started approximately 31 years ago by a Dutchman named Wilfried Zimmerman. And when he started his company, he was stepping for the first time into this category of business, and he decided to use the word polder, which, aside from reclaimed land, one of the common use translations would be to make something from nothing. And that's how he started his business, bringing kind of high-end European housewares into the United States market.
How is that something from nothing?
Well, because I guess he had nothing before he started this.
Oh, there you go. That's interesting. So is the company still based in the Netherlands, or is it based here now?
No, you know what? He actually was in New York and just was kind of keeping some of his Dutch heritage with him at every moment. And the company was purchased, I'd say, about 5 years ago by an American named Calvin Scott. And since then, we've kind of, you know, evolved the brand in today's marketplace.
Now, you're such a soft-spoken marketing guy. I'm going to have to remind you that you need to give me a little more volume.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Basically, since then, we've taken a kind of design-oriented and user-centered innovation focus on our products in the market today.
Now, Anne found you because of one particular line that you specialize in, which is kitchen timers.
Yes.
Because I'm a bit of a freak for making sure that I have everything on a timer, because I'm not confident in my ability to be able to gauge it any other way.
That,
and you sent me three or four of the highest tech looking timers I've ever seen.
That's music to my ears.
Now, I mean, why do you, I haven't found a use for the one that has three different timers in the same unit, although I'm sure if I could triple track cooking, then I probably would.
Basically, that's what it focused. That's really what it comes down to. You know, our timers are purchased for lots of different reasons. People, everything from, you know, soccer coaches to people timing themselves for homework and such. But really, the core of our market and how we develop these products is always based on people's cooking in the kitchen.
And the second area is thermometers.
Very much so, yes. You know, really, in the end, cooking and kind of perfect results when you're cooking are a matter of temperature and time. That's the bottom line.
Yeah, the highest tech-looking thing is the one that allows you to take temperature when you're grilling out. I mean, it looks like a scientific instrument.
That's our barbecue safe serve.
That's the one.
That's a high-end piece. That's you know, that one is more of a passion too, because grilling in the States is, you know, that is a full-time lifestyle approach now for a lot of people when they entertain. So we made that with kind of the home griller in mind. And the main thing about it is, aside from the fact that it folds up fairly close so that you can store it, when you open it, your hand is kept away from the grill. So you're a full foot off the grill when you're checking your meat temperature.
There you go. So it'd be perfect if you were going to do a fried turkey for Thanksgiving. It's exactly the tool you'd need.
Exactly. Well, you know, even to be honest with you, that piece works just as well in the kitchen. If you've ever had a big roast in the oven, you know, to get in there to do an instant read, you have to put on the oven mitts. And if you have an oven, an in-oven piece, you still have to look through and kind of squint your eyes at it. This piece, because it's so long, you don't even have to get your hands in the oven. You can just stick it right in there. And it kind of makes it very easy for the user.
Now, where do these great design ideas come from?
Generally speaking, it's about, you know, taking a look at what's out there, and then it's getting in the kitchen and kind of just experimenting, watching people cook and use tools in the kitchen. A lot of time, best ideas come from the biggest problems. So we spend a good amount of time with home economists, as well as, you know, our families, just kind of watching, observing, and coming up with concepts.
I love the paper towel holder. Now, I didn't install it under the cabinets. That's
right.
Much too difficult for me. So I'm using it placed vertically, but it solves the number one problem that I experienced with the towel holder that I used before, which was inside of a door in a cupboard. And when I would tug on it with one hand hard to try to tear off a sheet,
yep,
the roll would always drop out of the holder.
Yes.
And in this case, there's just enough resistance on the part of the mechanism, that's, I guess, the spindle that holds
yep,
the towel, that in fact, if you rip, it does actually tear away at the tear.
Yeah, what happens is, you know, we were looking at how people use paper towel holders, and, you know, everything is getting so high-tech with products nowadays. You know, you have, I think there's one out there where you put your hand in front of a sensor and it spits out a paper towel for you to tear off. we kind of reversed that, and what we did is we just used rubber in very strategic places, and what it does, it allows just enough friction so that you can have control. If you want to pull out two sheets and then tear, or one sheet, you don't have to worry about the rest of the roll coming after you.
There we go. Well, in my case, it always seemed to fall on the floor. And there was one particular brand that was particularly bad at it. I won't blackball it on the air.
You know, the other thing about this product is the dual position nature of it. That's kind of the lead element. Really what it is a lot of people find convenience if they have a spot underneath their kitchen cabinet for to hang a paper towel holder. That's great, but you know, if you decide you want to eat out on the porch for the this evening, or there's a big spill in another room, this unit will allow you to remove it from a real simple hook connection. You just lift off, and you can take it with you, and then it performs, you know, admirably as a 3-pound upright.
There you go. Well, that's how we're using it, because under every cabinet space in our kitchen is a fluorescent light, so there's no place to put a paper towel holder.
Danger.
Now, now these products are designed in the ingenuity is American, but the manufacturing is somewhere else.
Yep, pretty much all of these products are made in China today, and that's that obviously goes for a majority of the products.
I hope they're not painted.
No, they're. You know what? We were very happy.
Go ahead.
Absolutely, we all breathed a sigh of relief once we realized our unknown genius in picking brushed stainless for our products.
There you go.
That's kind of our motif.
Now, what's coming next?
Well, we're working on things to help what I would call the non-professional cook, make products more that are more intuitive for them. So we've got a thermometer coming out that alerts you when you are at a stable read. You know, most people walk up to their roast, they put it in there, they're watching the temperature climb, and basically if you stand there for long enough, it'll just keep climbing. So we have a built-in device that, you know, beeps to tell you that, okay, this is the current temperature, you can stop reading it. It speeds the process and makes the product more of what it is, which is not the star, but just a kind of a quiet helper in the process, you know?
There you go.
We're also doing some timers for people with different needs. We've got timers with lighting in them, and we've got timers that vibrate as well. What it does is, it'll allow everyone from deaf people to people who have narcolepsy are going to wake up when they use these products.
Oh, that's incredible. I mean, you're so thoughtful. I don't know how Anne found your company, but I tell you, you're really thoughtful people.
And, well, I'm looking to sell product. You know, there's a lot of markets out there.
Oh, I see. Okay, so this is the Polder Edge.
It's what I call win-win.
There we go. Well, now how can people find Polder products?
Polder is available right on our website. You can find a where to buy list, which is www.polder.com. But we are in most major specialty stores, from Sur La Table to Linens and Things, Bed Bath and Beyond. But again, on our website, you'll be able to see a more regional breakout of where we sell our items.
Do you have one particular product, aside from the ones that we talked about, that you think just has some it's just sort of understated brilliance about it?
My favorite item, if I had to pick out of our whole line, would be our comp. It's a very simple product. It's a compact dish rack. And what it is an extremely small dish rack. It is probably 6 inches wide by a foot long. It holds 15 plates and as many utensils as you can stuff into it. But it also serves as a party buffet server. So if you're hosting any parties, everyone can take their plates and utensils and eating things with them. You know, it's just an elegant little piece that fits a need for me.
We love it. The other thing about it that's wonderful is it has a stainless steel tray under the bottom so that you don't slop water all over your counter.
That's right.
When you rack things up.
Yeah, you know, it's just that if you've ever lived in a cramped space, those are the kinds of things that become the everyday.
In fact, we gave it to the person we know who has the most cramped kitchen that we know. It happens to be our son and daughter-in-law who live in a very small house in South Carolina. There's almost no kitchen room, and I don't think they'd even thought of the idea that you'd be able to find a dish rack to fit in there.
Yeah.
So we were so delighted with the sample. We sent it off to them, and they're so pleased to have it.
Oh, I love it.
I mean, it's the kind of thing that makes all the difference, and this thoughtfulness, this something out of nothing idea. I think Mr. Polder named the company very well.
True. And you know what? The funny thing, we're having fun. We're actually, you got to have a passion for it, and we enjoy the process.
Well, you must get back to us and let us know when you have something exciting and new coming out. And we'll get to talk again. In the meantime, thank you so much for joining us today. Listeners, it's www.polder.com. If you're looking for gadgets that help make your life easier, that allow you to save space, that stop you from ruining the food, this is the place to go.
Many thanks, Peter.
Okay, Carrie, bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's our show, listeners, for another week. Even a couple of bonus minutes in there, so we hope you enjoyed the whole show, and you'll join us again, same time, same place, next week at www.onthemenuradio.com.